Although we can't use the studio at the moment, Debbie Heath, one of our regular book reviewers, audiobook reviewers, is kindly joining me on the internet. We've got all our technological stuff sorted out, and now we're going to talk about Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne. Now, why did you pick that one? What was interesting to you about that?
My children were asking my husband and I what we'd enjoyed watching at their age, and we remembered a really long-winded cartoon adaptation of Around the World in 80 Days. We showed them a bit of that, and I thought to myself, you know, this really is a cracking story and so engaging for young people. So I thought, I've never actually read the book, and seemed like a good time. That's how I came to read it. And since then, my 10-year-old and I have seen the Steve Coogan film. My husband's read the book. You know, we're all quite into it, really. You've read it as well, of course, haven't you, Rob?
Yes, and I'm so old that I saw a much earlier film version. I think it was made in the 1950s. It was real, actually. It wasn't animated. And it was David Niven playing Phileas Fogg, the English principal traveller and the character. And I don't remember anything about it, except I remember seeing it. And I didn't read it until you suggested it.
It's such a well-known story. And of course, Michael Palin did his own travel program based on it. It's something that's there within all of us, but very few of us have actually read it. So it's a marvellous thing to be doing now when we can't really travel in real life, not with COVID. So let's escape through literature.
Of course, it's not the only book that Jules Verne wrote. We have to say he's French. He wrote in French and it was translated into English.
Mm.
It continues to be quite popular in translations, isn't it?
Yeah, apparently he's only second to Agatha Christie in terms of being an author who's been widely translated. I think some of the early translations weren't that good and were very much abridged, but this one seems to be very good and it's very English in style.
Well, yes, his main influences on his writing were French. I mean, he was particularly taken by the work of Victor Hugo, who wrote very large French novels. So it's interesting. You say you find the structure of it very English.
The whole thing seems English to me. But it was an interesting time, wasn't it? Because it was towards the end of, well, actually, officially after the Industrial Revolution. This was happening all over the world, not just in England. And so this is a time where travel had changed enormously. For instance, the Suez Canal, the linking, well, they say linking of the Indian railways, but as our character discovers, it hasn't quite been finished. But this was a really exciting time for people, especially the adventurers. And what I haven't been able to find out was whether the article that Phileas Fogg and his friends in the Reform Club were reading was a real one. And there was a newspaper article that said it is now possible to cross the world in 80 days.
What Verne set out to do, because he was fascinated by science and knowledge and geography and all those sorts of things, he wanted to write novels which were both scientific and factual and exploratory and yet were fictional and yet were with characters and invented. And he sort of did that, not just in this one, but he's got the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was one of it. I mean, they were all filmed frequently. There was lots of films made of his main few novels. They were good tales which transferred to film very well. Could be exciting.
They were so exciting that apparently some people really believed they were real. You know, obviously his attention to detail was so good. So people were really expecting Fogg to come back to London.
As I understand it, it was published in series, almost a Dickensian thing. And I think they held the last episode until the day that he would have come back in the book. They made it feel as if it was real, and the whole reading world was waiting. Was he going to get back in time?
I believe that he had some experience of travel himself, so that obviously came through.
His travelling was quite local in the sense that he had a couple of boat trips, and one was up to Scotland, I think, and another one was across to Scandinavia. But they came on the back of quite an interesting association throughout his childhood, because his mother came from a family of seafarers and boat people. Then when he went off to first boarding school at the age of six, his teacher had actually lost her husband. He disappeared at sea. And even 30 years later, she was convinced he was going to come back. And there's even a tale that at the age of 11, he got taken on board a ship to travel to the Indies. He was going to be the cabin boy. And his father found out just in time and came and whisked him off and said, from now on, travel in your imagination and not in fact. The story wasn't true, of course, but it was a good story at the time.
Thank goodness he did have such a good imagination, because it really is a very exciting concept, that, you know, the idea of the book. Maybe it's the story that carries the book and not the characters, but shall we talk about the characters?
Phileas Fogg was not known to have either wife or children, which happens to the most honest people, nor relatives or near friends, which is certainly more unusual. He lived alone in his house in Savile Row, whither none penetrated. A single servant sufficed to serve him. He had lunch and dinner at the club, at hours mathematically fixed, in the same room, at the same table, never taking his meals with other members, much less bringing a guest with him, and went home at exactly midnight, only to retire at once to bed.
Very strange fellow. He's a bit of a loner, lives on his own, doesn't socialise, except for going to the Reform Club, which is quite a prestigious gentleman's club. My first impression when reading it, finding out about his attention to detail, his obsession with time, I thought, ooh, bit of an obsessive personality, not great social skills. You know, could this be one of the first literary autistic heroes? He's certainly set in his ways. He loves his routine. He sacked his previous valet for bringing him his shaving water when it was 2 degrees too cold. As time goes on, I think the idea of autism isn't correct because he has a very adventurous streak. He enters into a wager and seems to be very, very calm. But I suppose it shows that we're all very contradictory people.
He certainly seemed to me quite two-dimensional in the beginning. I thought, well, I really cannot penetrate this character. Whereas the other characters, which we'll come to a little bit later, have got depth and all sorts of sides to them, he's very, very straight. And it's also very late Victorian, Edwardian, that sort of, you don't give away anything.
A stiff upper lip.
Yes, it was very much like that. And yet he, as you say, he's quite a surprising character because what he's trying to do is get round the world in 80 days because he's going to win a lot of money if he does it. He's going to lose a lot of money if he doesn't because of the wager with his friends at the Reform Club.
Yes, it's just something that seemed to come up very spontaneously. He seemed to want to prove a point. And it's gone against everything that has come before about this character. Suddenly, he is willing to pack his bags and leave that very evening. And he's just hired a new valet, poor old Passepartout, who's just arrived and thought, yeah, this is a nice quiet life, is whisked away on the trip of a lifetime.
He is quite a character by contrast, isn't he? I can remember in the film he was played by, actually he was a Mexican actor, but he had very much the sort of character of what you think of as a French humorous sort of peasant background, that all-rounded, oh my, well, you know, he really has a lot to say and has a lot of feelings which he brings out. And his contrast there with Phileas Fogg, who has apparently no feelings, though we come back to that later. I wondered whether, because he was a Frenchman writing about the English in French, he knew the English and he was quite fond of the country as a whole, though he hadn't ever visited it, I don't think. I wondered when the name Fogg, you know what the French say about England? Apart from being a nation of shopkeepers, it's also a very foggy land. And I just wondered if there was a game there being played.
Though I hadn't thought about that, and I also hadn't thought about the fact that this is a foreigner writing about the English, and that's probably how we seemed at that time, very, very straight. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Because in his youth, he trained to be a lawyer. His father wanted him to be a lawyer, so he went to Paris and he did all the right things, though he knew he was never going to, and he tried to, and he became a writer while he was studying to be a lawyer. And it was in the time when France was in upheaval. It was this sort of the second revolutionary period, the mid-1800s, the sort of thing that Victor Hugo's novel Les Misérables talks about, the barricades, the revolution in the streets, trying to overthrow the government and the power structure and so on. So that was the context he was living in Paris. So by contrast, nice, quiet, empire-obsessed Britain, or England in particular, must have been quite different.
Yes, and quite therapeutic, I would imagine.
Let's talk about Passepartout, which literally means sort of passes through everywhere. But I mean, I think it means he gets out of all scrapes. That's the nickname he's picked up. Whatever goes wrong, he always finds a way out of it.
We know that Passepartout had a previous life as a circus entertainer, which makes him a lovely counterpart to the uptight Fogg. He seems to have got in and out of scrapes quite a lot and is a very charismatic person. But yeah, he has a background. We feel like he's a friend. We get to know him. He seems to be our little view into the proceedings.
He gets into all sorts of scrapes. Yeah, you know, he loses his shoes at one point somewhere in the world. I can't remember where. I think he gets drunk. I can't remember, but he certainly gets...
I think he takes opium, doesn't he? Accidentally.
Yes.
But he always gets back on track. He's there as a very good counterpart to Fogg. And our other main character, Ayuda, who is an Indian princess, I feel is rather underused.
This was Victorian and Edwardian times when women were frequently, in fiction, were underused.
And, of course, she was a foreign woman, so particularly so. Basically, what happened is that when travelling in India, they came across a woman who was about to be sacrificed, that is, Ayuda, because her husband had died. So they felt that she should be sacrificed as well. And this is what happened in this area of India. And our heroes won't have any of it. And they decide that she has to be rescued by them, and quickly.
The young woman had again fallen into a stupor, caused by the fumes of the hemp. She passed among the fakirs who escorted her with their wild religious cries. Phileas Fogg and his companions, mingling in the rear ranks of the crowd, followed, and in 2 minutes they reached the banks of the stream and stopped 50 paces from the pyre upon which still lay the Raja's corpse. In the semi-obscurity, they saw the victim, quite senseless, stretched out beside her husband's body. Then a torch was brought, and the wood, soaked with oil, instantly took fire. At this moment, Sir Francis and the guide seized Phileas Fogg, who, in an instant of mad generosity, was about to rush upon the pyre. But he had quickly pushed them aside when the whole scene suddenly changed. A cry of terror arose. The whole multitude prostrated themselves, terror-stricken, on the ground. The old Raja was not dead then, since he rose of a sudden like a spectre, took up his wife in his arms, and descended from the pyre in the midst of the clouds of smoke, which only heightened his ghostly appearance. Fakirs, soldiers, and priests, seized with instant terror, lay there with their faces on the ground, not daring to lift their eyes and behold such a prodigy. The inanimate victim was borne along by the vigorous arms which were carrying her, and in which she did not seem a burden. Mr. Fogg and Sir Francis stood erect. The Parsee bowed his head, and Passepartout was, no doubt, scarcely less stupefied. The resuscitated Raja approached Sir Francis and Mr. Fogg, and in an abrupt tone said, "Let us be off." It was Passepartout himself, who had slipped upon the pyre in the midst of the smoke, and taking advantage of the still overhanging darkness, had delivered the young woman from death. It was Passepartout who, playing his part with a happy audacity, was passing through the crowd amid the general terror.
It's far from easy for them because they're under observation. They can't just walk in and rescue her. They have to hatch a plot, which, of course, is something that they find themselves doing as they go around the world. They're always, or often Passepartout is hatching the plot, but they're thinking of a way out of a situation, and that is part of the adventure of the story, isn't it?
Yes, and of course we don't want to give too much away, but when they take her away, she's actually not aware of what's going on. She's been drugged up on something.
So you've got the principal characters, although there are other ones that we encounter on the way, because after all, they are travelling by boat, by train, they're travelling overland, lots of different ways, and that's the whole point. It's an exploration of all the sorts of different ways in which you can get around the world, in a way.
And incidentally, there is no hot air balloon. It's often marketed with a hot air balloon on the front cover. And the recent Steve Coogan film involved a hot air balloon. But that is a different story by Jules Verne. The only other character I think worth mentioning, there has to be an antagonist, doesn't there, for every thrilling adventure story. And I thought this one was fantastic. We should just summarise that at the same time that Fogg and his associates in the Reform Club are hatching the deal, there has been a grand theft at the Bank of England. And unfortunately for Fogg, the image that the police artist has conjured up from a witness account looks very similar to him. So at the same time as their adventure story is happening, Detective Inspector Fix of Scotland Yard is trying to track down Fogg. But not only that, he has to wait to arrest him because he's not allowed to do it unless he's on British territory. He has to have a warrant. At one point, I think when they're in Hong Kong and they're on British territory, Fix is eagerly awaiting a warrant so that he can make the arrest.
Hong Kong was the last English ground on which he would set foot. Beyond, China, Japan, America offered Fogg an almost certain refuge. If the warrant should at last make its appearance in Hong Kong, Fix could arrest him and hand him to the local police, and there would be no further trouble. But beyond Hong Kong, a simple warrant would be of no avail. An extradition warrant would be necessary, and that would result in delays and obstacles, of which the rascal would take advantage to elude justice. Fix thought over these probabilities during the long hours which he spent in his cabin.
And I won't tell you whether it comes or not, but he's always, always one step behind Fogg, and he has a bit of bad luck, and you can't help feeling sorry for him, really. I believe in one of the adaptations, this role was played by Eric Idle, and I think he would have done it very well. So Fix has very clear motivation. He experiences some very complex emotions during the book. I think he's hilarious, although he doesn't always act in an honourable fashion.
The interesting relationships are between Passepartout and Fix, because again, it's no accident that one is French and one is English. One is an official and the other is, as you say, an ex-circus performer. And that sort of balance really makes it very amusing. That's one of the reasons why it works in visual terms on film or whatever, usually.
And they keep misunderstanding each other's motives, don't they? They always think that they understand what's going on and then they don't, and it's all very funny.
By going round the world at that time, they are effectively travelling through much of the British Empire. So a lot of the territory is ones on which Fix could have arrested Fogg if only he'd had the paperwork. The paperwork was always running just after him.
Yes, that's right. He was always waiting for these warrants. This is a very important part of the book, actually. It's an interesting slice of history, isn't it? And I found the educational tone of the book fascinating, because not many people did travel then. It's a little, really interesting little insight into the time that the book was written. So yeah, gentlemen might have travelled for business, sailors travelled, but it wasn't the norm. So Verne helped his readers to travel virtually, giving them a bit of political context, knowing that should they ever want to try a world tour, they could do it with a degree of comfort.
He was very intent on communicating knowledge as well as of a novel. I mean, he did want to do that. He's really said that, and his publisher said that. That's why he was going to produce his series, and he did produce a series of books which were sort of educational as well as fun.
And things really do happen. It's a classic Holy Grail-style quest. Everyone's a sucker for an adventure story, aren't they? There is escape, there's excitement, death, all sorts of things. And, you know, the end, which we're not going to give away, is brilliant. And even Fogg, even him, his character does develop. Certainly by the end, we get more of a sense of who he is. So it's a surprising, and yet it's not just a rollicking adventure story. It is a slice of history, and it really does make you think about how things have changed and how lucky we are to be able to travel. Well, outside of COVID, maybe.
With an adventure story like this, you really want to say how it ends and you want to say, but we can't say any of that. We've said it goes through to the Mediterranean, through Africa, across to India, across India, across the Pacific. Then you've got to cross America. Then you've got to get back to England. With lots of opportunities for different lots of characters to appear, but also different settings, because each of those parts of the world is very different. You would have thought that Jules Verne had actually been there because he creates such good contexts in which things happen. But he hasn't been there. He's just read the books.
There are so many different serialisations of it, and we can all find our own 80 Days version that we like the best. About 15 years ago, there was a Steve Coogan film, and that was quite interesting because it changed Fogg's character enormously, and it made him a quirky inventor who is very charismatic, and that really annoyed me. But my 10-year-old son loved it. So it turned it into an engaging family film. So they twisted it. They, you know, they had the main plot, but they changed the characters so much. So it didn't work for me, but obviously it works for some people. And because it is a timeless tale, you've all got to find your own favourite version. And you might find that when, you know, your favourite childhood version isn't the same as your favourite grown-up version, you might want to do your own 80-day trip when we're allowed to. And apart from the adventure and the excitement, it's a really interesting social commentary and slice of history. And yeah, there are twists and turns all the way. I was really glad I read it, and I'm not hesitating to recommend it to people. And most people say, I've never actually read that. I think most people would find it a very enjoyable read.
Thank you very much, Debbie. Thank you. It's difficult doing these conversations on the internet, but we look forward to being back in one studio or another fairly soon. Next year sometime, we don't know when. So thanks to Debbie for leading us through that adventure tale come travelogue. Great fun. And thanks also to Caliber Audio, which provided the CD from which we were able to take the extracts. They were read by Ian Wallace. Caliber Audio is a charity based in Aylesbury, which provides audiobooks for those who, for one reason or another, are unable to read the books in their printed version. It's a great charity.